Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club, Oral SIRS Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today, meeting with Dr. Seth Wander from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to discuss several recent papers, beginning with an excellent review article on ESR1 mutations and the recent evolution of clinical and translational research data on detection of these alterations and new strategies to therapeutically target these lesions, including the use of selective estrogen receptor degraders.
This is a great paper because it's right there in the title, right? Clinical utility of ESR1 mutations. So how are we actually thinking about these mutations in the clinic? And the way I usually conceptualize this is when you think about breast cancer that's untreated, either at the time of initial diagnosis in the primary setting, or if you have de novo metastatic disease, the patient's never seen an antiestrogen, the likelihood of having a mutation in ESR1, which is the gene that encodes the estrogen receptor, is very rare, less than 5%, less than 3%. But if you start to look at patients who've had a long duration of antiestrogen therapy, typically an aromatase inhibitor, either in the adjuvant or the first-line metastatic setting, you start to see an enrichment in those alterations in ESR1 creeping up, depending on how much prior exposure the population has had. The mutations tend to cluster in the ligand-binding domain of the protein, and what happens is, under selective pressure, when you take away the ligand because of the aromatase inhibitor, these mutations allow the receptor to turn themselves on without the estrogen signal. And that's why the aromatase inhibitor doesn't work, because it doesn't matter what your estradiol level is, you know, throughout the body. And so what we see is, if you look at the second line metastatic, third line metastatic, fourth line metastatic setting, we see creeping up the frequency of the ESR1 mutations upwards of, 20 to 30%, even as high as 40 to 50% in some series. And this becomes critically important because we have these newer drugs that are being developed, including elacestrant, which was FDA approved, as well as a whole host of other agents that are specifically active in the ESR1 mutant population. These next generation oral selective estrogen receptor degraders, upcoming selective estrogen receptor modulators, proteolysis targeting chimeras, all these drugs have unique activity, particularly in the ESR1 mutant population. And so we know that a patient with an ESR1 alteration is unlikely to benefit from an aromatase inhibitor. We know that those tumors are still ER dependent. The tumor still requires estrogen receptor downstream signaling to grow and divide. And we have these great new therapeutic opportunities with these drugs to hinder that process. The issue is the activity as a single agent for these drugs has been somewhat underwhelming in terms of clinical magnitude of benefit. And so the future, which is coming, is combining those drugs with first generation targeted agents like PI3 kinase CDK inhibitors, and then soon with next generation targeted agents. So newer PI3 kinase AKT inhibitors, CDK4, CDK2, RAS pathway, et cetera. And then we'll really start to hopefully see some synergy, and some longer duration of clinical response.
So does the evolution or presence of ESR1 mutations necessarily mean that the disease is going to clinically relapse?
Yeah, we haven't necessarily proven that in these large prospective studies. And a study like SERENA-6, where they're actually tracking the emergence and development of these ESR1 mutations in real time before clinical progression, before there's any radiographic change, and they're trying to address your question by intervening, by switching therapy without clinical progression, I think we'll learn something from that. If intervening early with an ESR1 targeted drug pays clinical dividends, it would suggest that that's actually a clear-cut marker of upcoming resistance that has clinically meaningful impact.
One final question. Any correlation between what's going on biologically in a patient? We had a patient the other day, somebody presented, who relapsed after 3 months on endocrine therapy compared to somebody who relapses 3 or 4 years later, in terms of the mutational profile early versus late.
Yeah, great question. We looked at what you're describing, intrinsic resistance, somebody who kind of blew through the CDK inhibitor with less than 6 months straight away, versus acquired resistance, somebody who did 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, and then progressed later. In our first initial look at that relatively small cohort, we didn't see a big pattern of these mutations in intrinsic versus these mutations in acquired. It just seemed to be a function of when did you get them? Were they there at the beginning or did they pop up later on? One of the interesting patterns we see is for patients who you mentioned who have upfront quick resistance, there's actually a lower frequency of ESR1. And for patients who do 12, 18, 24 plus months, there's a higher frequency of ESR1. And my hypothesis, which we still need to kind of test and verify, is that if you have one of these bad mutations, whether it's RB or RAS or something like that, and you blow through the CDK inhibitor, you haven't had enough time on the aromatase inhibitor to get the ESR1. Whereas if you don't have the alteration and you sit on the CDK inhibitor for a year, for 18 months, for 24 months, you're actually giving the tumor more time to do what we just talked about, which is to develop the pressure to get the ESR1 mutation. We're starting to see just beginning the hints of what the patterns of resistance might look like for the 12-week, you know, progressor versus the patient who might be 24 months. But there's a lot to be done there.
So this paper just got published in the JCO, but I think the data had been presented before this. The phase 1A-1B AMBER study of imlunestrant, another SERD, is yet unapproved. What was the background to this study and what did they see?
Yeah, so this is one of the original experiences with imlunestrant. We talked before about the preoperative window of opportunity study. Here's the phase 1 study in the metastatic setting. This was a really big phase 1 study because it had a lot of different arms to it. I think in one of our prior conversations, we talked about the experience with this drug in the HER2 positive, ER positive. Here, we're looking at the ER positive, HER2 negative, variable degree of CDK4/6 pretreatment. And they looked at three different scenarios. They looked at imlunestrant oral SERD monotherapy, imlunestrant plus abemaciclib, and then imlunestrant plus abema plus an AI. Sort of a triplet regimen. The thing to remember here, though, is in the imlunestrant monotherapy arm, there was a fair degree of prior CDK4/6 inhibitor treatment. In the combo arms with fulvestrant, I think these patients were either mostly or entirely CDK4/6 naive. So that, you know, that's driving a lot of the data here in terms of the abema response. But in any event, we see in general that the patients did pretty well here. The overall response rate for the single agent was about 12% in a more treatment refractory population. And the overall response rates in the combo was on the order of 30 to 60% in a less heavily pretreated population. Clinical benefit rates were really high. And of course, you know what I'm going to say about this. This is the data that's really, really exciting to me.
Any more data on safety?
Yeah, so this looks good. We expect to see an EMBER-3, much larger, you know, several hundred patients in these groups looking at this. And again, the take-home message is there's some GI stuff related to the imlunestrant. Most of it is low grade. And interestingly, when you look at the diarrhea here, there again wasn't a ton of high-grade diarrhea on the order of, you know, 10-ish percent when you combine with the abemaciclib. And, you know, the other stuff mostly is driven by abemaciclib. You see some cytopenias, you see some fatigue, right, et cetera. But the drugs are well tolerated. We have tons of experience with abema, and the imlunestrant doesn't add too much.
Another thing I really love are these trials in progress posters that you see at so many meetings nowadays. This one's from the recent ESMO meeting, looking at the TREAT ctDNA study, which evaluates the use of elacestrant in patients receiving adjuvant endocrine therapy with ctDNA relapse.
This is a wonderful study, and this is exactly the direction we need to go. I'm glad you picked this study. So here, what they're doing is they're screening almost 2,000 patients with stage 2 or 3 ER-positive HER2-negative breast cancer who've been on sort of moderate to long duration of adjuvant endocrine therapy. And they're using this new kind of MRD, minimum residual disease monitoring technology, Signatera, which is just coming into clinical practice. I have patients coming in to ask me about it almost every week now. The good thing about Signatera is it's a personalized DNA barcode where they take the primary tumor, they look at the SNPs and the mutational profile, and they're able to develop an assay with a very, very high degree of sensitivity that can detect fragments of that tumor's DNA in the blood. And if that DNA is present, the likelihood of recurrence in the near term over the next year or so is extremely, extremely high, you know, on the order of 80 to 90 plus percent. If it's negative, the likelihood of recurrence, again, in the near term, over the next year or two, is extremely, extremely low. And we've seen it in GI, colon cancer, et cetera. The prognostic value is really rock solid. However, we don't yet have interventional data. This study, in that context, is screening about 2,000 patients. They hope to find a little over 200 patients who meet the eligibility criteria, which is they're Signatera positive, meaning they have tumor DNA in the blood, but their scans are negative. They have no clinical symptoms and no radiographic findings. So here you have a window to intervene. And what they're going to do is they're going to randomize those patients to stay on their current endocrine therapy and now get scans every 4 months for the next couple of years, or they're going to switch them to elacestrant, next generation oral SERD. And again, scan every 4 months for the next couple of years. So this is a brilliant study. One of the problems with Signatera is because it's barcoded to the original tumor, coming back to our discussion about acquired resistance, it doesn't tell you anything about why the DNA is there. What if the patient got a new ESR1 mutation? Signatera cannot detect that, right? Signatera can only tell you that there's DNA there. It doesn't tell you what changed in the DNA. And so in my opinion, this is going to be a really interesting study, because the question becomes, of all the 220 people they find, how many of them are growing because of ESR1? And you would think that those people, this would be a great strategy for. But perhaps if they're growing for some other reason, because they acquired, you know, activated RAS, or because they got Aurora kinase or something, this maybe isn't the best strategy. And so I think ultimately the technologies need to converge. We need to have something like Signatera, tumor-informed, highly sensitive to detect recurrence. But we also need to have something like Guardant with somatic testing, or the technology where you can go really, really deep to a fraction of a percent allelic fraction to say, okay, the Signatera is positive. Why? Did they get ESR1? Did they get something else? That's where you see these roads converging and helping us make the best decisions we can in clinic. But this is a really exciting study, and this is the sort of study that will radically change the approach to breast cancer care in clinic, you know, for everybody in any setting.